Well, we had some terrific feedback on our discussion last week about the surge in renewables going right around the country, state by state. The private sector and state governments really deciding not to wait for a federal government plan. One thing we didn't talk about was jobs, and in particular, whether there'll be options for coal industry workers in this new area of industry. Well, we have some new information on that, and it's quite encouraging. We'll also hear about an interesting new alliance that's been formed in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, coal country, of course. Unions and environmental groups in the Hunter have got together to counter what they see as a false dichotomy about jobs versus the environment. You can look after both, they are saying, though it's not completely casualty-free. Steve Murphy is the National Secretary of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, the AMWU, one of the key unions in the new Hunter Jobs Alliance, just launched earlier this month. And Chris Briggs is Research Principal at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology in Sydney. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Good morning.
And we've got good morning.
Quite a bit to get through, so I'll move through it. Chris, you were on our program last year when you and some UTS colleagues were just starting the first large-scale Australian survey of renewable energy deployment, and that was completed this year. Specifically, what were you looking at, first of all?
Yeah, we surveyed over 450 renewable businesses, looking to find out how many and what types of workers are employed in wind farms, solar farms, rooftop solar, hydro and pumped hydro and battery storage, trying to understand how many people are employed and how many might be employed in renewables and what role they might play within coal regions as well.
And then you tried to peer into the future by using three different scenarios established by the energy market operator, the AEMO, and each scenario was different according to how quickly and comprehensively the shift to renewables happens. So we won't go into the details, but overall, would you say it's a pretty healthy outlook for jobs in renewables? Because I think you calculated that even if, especially if Australia were to set policies in line with the Paris Climate Agreement, there'd actually be a jobs boom.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's currently around about 26,000 people employed in renewables. The main employer is rooftop solar and then wind farms. And people typically think of an installer on a roof, but there's quite a diverse range of trades, labourers, professionals employed across the sector. And we did look at the scenarios using the forecasts of the energy market operator, and we found the industry could grow to, with the right support, to around 45,000 jobs. And I think it's important
by
that
when?
Also that's
by when?
By 2025.
Oh, right. Okay.
Whereas the central scenario, which they use, which is current policies, could see a jobs fall to around 15,000. So there's quite a big difference depending on the policy support and development of the industry.
And where would those jobs be, roughly?
Well, I guess the point also to make is that it's a conservative estimate because we looked at the core industry, the building and the operation and maintenance of projects, but it's also going to create jobs. There's going to be a global surge in demand for minerals like nickel and copper and lithium that are going to be needed to build wind turbines and batteries. So there's going to be a growth in non-coal mining, Western Australia, but also some of the areas close to current coal mining areas. There's a lot of opportunities in supply chains, which Steve will probably perhaps talk about. We don't employ very many people in manufacturing, but on the back of last week's announcement of renewable energy zones, BlueScope has already announced a $20 million precinct to grow steel manufacturing. We could, as you heard last week, grow an export sector, and we only looked at the domestic power system, so we could end up running cables to Indonesia or exporting renewable hydrogen through LNG terminals in Gladstone, so you know, current carbon-intensive areas. And there's also the possibility that we could use our very high-quality solar and wind resources to develop comparative advantage in energy-intensive industries like steel and aluminium.
Right.
So we heard last week Minister Keane saying that he thought with their renewable energy zones that New South Wales could be in the bottom 10% of costs for electricity in the OECD. So, you know, it could be a plan to grow also steel and aluminium jobs
Yes,
so,
I mean,
a whole range of opportunities.
I think there's another important little statistic in your report. By 2035, you estimate that as many as half of renewable energy jobs could be ongoing jobs in operation and maintenance, because that'd be something I think listeners would really say, yes, is this all in the startup operation? And then it falls away.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, most of the jobs currently are in construction and, you know, in regional areas. You know, you'll see a boom sometimes and then there's not a lot of workers left behind. But, of course, over time, as you build more and more, then you need more and more maintenance staff. So if you've ever seen those spectacular photos of people on top of the wind turbines, they're the sort of electrical and mechanical technicians needed to maintain them. And over time, as you build more and more of them, then, of course, you need more and more maintenance staff. So that's right. Over time, as we build out the fleet, there'll be more and more ongoing jobs.
Okay, and just before I bring Steve Murphy in, coal workers, how likely is it that they will be the ones who can get these jobs?
So renewables creates jobs across a wider range of areas, whereas coal really concentrates them around the resource itself. We looked at where the jobs might be created in these renewable energy zones and how they overlap with coal regions. And the answer is they will create jobs in coal regions, but not in the volumes or quantities needed to be a replacement sector. So what we found is that it will create jobs like electricians, mechanical technicians that could allow for transfer, but not in the volume needed. And so we really need a transition plan that looks at the opportunities to grow renewables, but also other industries within coal regions.
Yes, I think it's the semi-skilled, isn't it? About one third of coal workers, drillers, machine operators, they just simply switch over. Okay, so that sets the scene. Now, Steve Murphy from the AMWU, just remind us, please, who your union represents.
Well, we represent quite a wide range of workers all across different areas of the coal industry supply chain. We kind of represent members who are building the mining machinery on the mine sites doing maintenance. They're contractors, they're maintaining the locomotives as well as the coal loaders and repairing the ships. So we're all the way through the supply chain.
And how many of them work in coal? What sort of roles?
Well, they're mostly maintenance and service workers, a lot of tradespeople, of course, mechanical tradespeople, but there's lots of semi-skilled workers in around mining as well that are members of the AMWU. And we've got 5,000 members up in through the Hunter Valley and obviously a lot more nationally, but we're saying that 80% of our members in Newcastle and the Valley are relying on, in some way, the coal industry for their family's financial security.
Right. Okay. Well, that puts it in context. The CFMEU, I understand, actually covers coal production, so which is separate from you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a separate area of coverage, and they're the workers that we're talking about earlier.
Okay. Tell us about this Hunter Jobs Alliance. It has nine unions in it. It was ranging from the ETU, the Electrical Trades Union, to nurses and teachers unions, and several environmental groups, including the Nature Conservation Council in New South Wales. So it was launched, but sort of somewhat got overtaken, I think, by other events like US elections and so on. What's the idea behind it?
Well, we watched the debate around action on climate change being narrowly focused by the media as, you know, Greens on, and the environmental movement on one side and rich bosses from the mining industry on the other. And neither of those groups really had the interest of working people as their priority as this was playing out. And we watched at the last election as unionised workers and the environmental movement were thrown at each other in this competition of jobs versus the environment. And when workers are given that choice, it's no surprise where they landed. And, you know, we got together after the election and said, that's not where the conflict is. We've actually got more in common. Our conflict is with private capital. And we actually need a plan because these decisions are going to be made in overseas boardrooms and it's going to be workers and their communities that are left behind to clean up the mess once mining companies start to pull out.
You were partly inspired, I understand, by the green bands of the 1970s, Jack Mundy and his like. What lessons do you think you can learn from the power of that movement?
Well, there's a whole lot we can learn from that. Of course, those green bands, you know, they were put in place to make sure that, you know, working people, when we got our 8 hours of leisure, had places that you could go to with your families to enjoy your leisure time. And, you know, we, at the early stages of the Hunter Jobs Alliance, what we said was that when workers' politics are ahead of the environmental movement, we will win. And, you know, we're putting together a whole lot of communication and talking to workers, and they're not difficult, they're not easy conversations, of course, they're difficult conversations to recognise, and workers are saying this themselves, that one is we know that there is a problem and we know that something's happening, Secondly, is we can't trust mining bosses or political parties to fix the problem. So we all need to accept that, you know, we all own the solution for it. It's not owned by one particular group, and we've got an obligation as a trade union to make sure that we're planning not just to protect our members' current jobs, but to plan for decent jobs into the future.
You haven't got access to private capital yourself, though, have you?
No, unfortunately, we don't get into private capital investment. We're there to look after working people. But there's a whole lot of interest. Like, there's a whole host of different people that are coming and looking at this from their own particular perspective, whether that be from workers' rights or the environmental movement, or, as you say, those people who have got private capital that are looking at a return. And we've devoted a lot of energy in the last 12 months to talking to workers and communities. And the focus for us is just to deliver a seat at the decision-making table for working people.
I suppose what I'm saying is, are you talking to private capital as well? Because you won't get anywhere, will you, necessarily, even however well you groom your own members, unless you can get access to other capital?
Yeah, well, you've got to talk to private capital in this, as much as we're in conflict with them on day-to-day stuff. But there are four things that we're hoping we can achieve. One is that we believe that you can have climate action and job creation. They are not mutually exclusive. Secondly, is we've got a big opportunity, you know, post-COVID world, big public support for things being made in Australia again. The third one is that there should be public ownership of our future energy needs. If we're going to keep costs down, then governments at a state and federal level got to play a role. And the fourth one, of course, and this is really important, is a just transition commitment, and that is justice for workers if there is going to be a transition away from coal mining.
Look, I'm just looking at the time, but of the various things that you say could be underway, realistically, what's the one that particularly appeals to you?
Well, there's a broad range of projects that are underway, you know, recycling coal ash, electric buses, electric machinery for the mining industry, rehabilitation, recycling. But the big one at the moment that we think will, you know, generate a lot of interest is securing cheap and reliable electricity, hopefully 100% renewable for Tomago Aluminium. You know, it employs thousands of workers.
That's between
upstream.
Maitland and Newcastle, isn't it?
In the halfway between Maitland and Newcastle. It's one of the biggest electricity union users in the state of New South Wales. 25% of Australia's primary aluminium is produced there, and we export to Asia and the Pacific. And if we can firm up, you know, renewable energy with a mix of solar and wind and hydrogen power to create green aluminium, we can also do that for steel, and we can do it for ammonia as well.
And look, I noticed that you say that your members eventually say they're not loyal to coal per se, they just want to have the financial security they currently have. And of course, coal workers are very well paid. Is that going to be able to be realistically continued?
Well, the reason that they're well paid is the same reason that most jobs are well paid, and that is that they've been unionised for a long period of time, and workers have struggled to make sure that they've got the best wages, the best conditions, the best hours of work, and the best long service leave. And we're seeing with the new energy, renewable energy that is popping up, that workers are being exploited. So we've got an obligation to make sure that any new jobs that are created are union jobs that have got good wages and good conditions. But we can also use our tax laws, that if workers are in genuine transition, be able to give them some level of tax concession so they're not plunged into poverty as a result of this transition.
Just quickly, what workers being exploited in the new industries, what do you mean?
So there's widespread reports on solar farms as an emerging industry that's really concerning. And, you know, this just shows the fault lines in the way that our economy is built. The ETU have been in there and have found widespread labour hire and wage theft and a lot of migrant workers and unskilled electricians.
Okay. So, look, just before I let you go, GrowCon, the big construction giant, appears to have collapsed. It's gone into the hands of administrators in the weekend. I know they're not your members primarily, but, you know, there's going to be a lot of people suffer from that.
Yeah, well, this is not something new to construction industry or to the manufacturing industry, to be honest. The company's going to the wall, and it's always workers and subcontractors and small business that are left to carry the can once these go to the wall. And it just shows why we need, at least in construction anyway, national security of payment laws and the introduction of statutory trust to make sure that, you know, when these things happen, workers are looked after.
Look, thank you very much indeed. It is very, you know, really quite encouraging. Steve Murphy from the ANWU and Chris Briggs, thank you to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And welcome your thoughts, and we'll keep our eye on that GrowCon story, which is a very big one, I think.